Ms. Schwendinger's work lives in at least two worlds, the violin writing, played with equal measures of energy and velvety richness by Jennifer Coe, is sometimes assertive and rhythmically sharp-edged, but those moments virtually always resolve into a sweetly singing line. The grittier orchestral writing offsets that sweetness without overwhelming it. This is a work that seems likely to blossom with repeated listening. So wrote Alan Kozin of the New York Times of composer Laura Schwendinger's Chiaroscuro Azzurro. How does a composer go about writing classical music today? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What are the uses of contemporary classical music? Where does the inspiration come from? And what's it like for a composer to collaborate with performers of his or her music? Our guest is Laura Schwendinger. She's the first composer to win the prestigious American Academy in Berlin Prize, and she's also a professor of composition at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and director of the Contemporary Ensemble. Her most recent CD, Three Works, includes solo premiere performances by cellist Matt Heimowitz, violinist Curtis McComber, and flutist Christina Jennings, and was recently released by Albany Records.
Welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you so much for having me. It's nice to be here.
How did you decide to become a composer? Was it through instrumental work and then into composition, or did you sort of always know long ago you were going to grow up and become a composer?
Well, I think it started when I was 6 or 7. I would make up little tunes and drive my parents crazy. And then at some point they decided, okay, they would buy a piano and see what would come of it. And that was when I was about 8. And it was the ugliest piano you've ever seen in your life. It was this big gray thing that looked like a coffin, an upright. And I would sit and I would make up little songs and little pieces. And I started studying flute the following year. And my very first flute recital that year, I played a piece, Opus 1. So I think it happened when I was pretty young.
When you say Opus 1, that usually means, well, it can mean either two things, either your first work or your first published work.
Well, it was my first work. I don't even know if it exists anywhere now in the world, except in my head still sometimes.
But that still is pretty unusual, isn't it, to play your own piece for your recital?
I think it was, and my flute teacher was surprised. But she was happy and excited, and I have to say that, I had a lot of support right away. I was lucky to study with Janice Gatek at the Casadero Music Camp, which is in Northern California, and that was when I was 9. So by the time I was 10, I was playing in a youth orchestra, and they premiered an orchestral piece of mine. So
that's pretty impressive.
I started fairly young.
Do you feel that you hear the tunes kind of in your head just all the time, like have a walking soundtrack going on?
I think that's a perfect way of explaining it because, you'll hear a sound, something like a beep, a car beep, and then that will give you a rhythm or a texture. And then you go home and inevitably that sort of filters into something musical. And the strangest things can inspire you. You know, you can wake up in the middle of the night with something in your head and thank goodness my husband's a sound sleeper.
And who do you look to in terms of the composers that influenced you the most?
Well, I think my most influential teacher, Andrew Imbrie, had a huge influence. He was probably one of the two or three best teachers of the 20th century, I would think. He had many famous students, and he was of the old school. He really made sure that our technique was clean. We knew about voice leading. We understood chord progressions. We understood counterpoint, all of those things that I try to instill in my students. And just the best gentleman. I can't tell you. A lot like John Harbison and how sweet and gentlemanly he is of the old school.
And how, when you work with a composer of some note, do you avoid, and does that composer avoid, you becoming a clone?
Well, that's, you know, that's a good question, because there was a period of time, I think, when I was in college, and I think all of my colleagues in college, all of my fellow graduate students felt, we felt sort of a push to write a certain style of music. And you might have heard this story before, especially when I went to school in the 80s and the 90s. It was very much the case. We were coming out of a certain style of music. And so my early pieces were more, I would say, complex than the music that I write now, although people find my music somewhat complex, and other people find it very sort of colorful and lyrical. So at the same time, I straddle stylistic worlds. And, you know, Andrew died a few years ago, my teacher, Andrew Imbrie, and I'm not sure how he would feel about the pieces I've written since he died. I don't know if he would find them a little bit too, you know, in the coloristic world.
But would that be a bad thing, to have your teacher have some misgivings about your work?
You know, I think that probably not. I think the more you challenge yourself, the better. And you can get into a space where you're doing work instead of feeling inspired.
For sure.
So if I wake up and I put down a phrase that, you know, sounds like something I've written before too much, I might just say to myself, okay, I'm going to do just the opposite. I really want to do something different.
Go out and hear a car horn.
Exactly.
I would think right now it would be sort of almost overwhelming for whether you're a contemporary artist in the visual arts or in music. It seems as if anything could go. You could do classical, kind of, you know, harkening back to centuries ago. You can do atonal. You can do improv and jazz. You can do sort of anything. Is that sometimes as overwhelming as it would be to go to a restaurant where there's so many things on the menu, you just want them to give you something? I mean, sometimes do you feel as if the array of styles can be bewildering almost?
I think you're right on some level, but it is also freeing, because it means you can try different things. And you know, people listening to my music, if they only heard one piece, they might think I'm in a stylistic world. And then they hear another piece and they think, oh, she's in a different stylistic world. And I think maybe perhaps I'm a little akin to the eclectic school, and that I really like that, you know, those many choices, although I still haven't taken anything from my pop experience. I was in a rock band when I was 13. A lot of people my age were. And so that's something I still haven't mined yet. I love Brahms. I love Bach. I love counterpoint. When I write my pieces, I write many layers of counterpoint, and then I sort of filter out some of those layers, because there's a certain amount that we can sort of take in it at any given time.
As the listener, yes, can only absorb so much. And after a while, how do you decide who you're writing for? I mean, when we've already talked about, you know, the academic underpinnings, and you have to learn all the techniques. And of course, if it's absolutely packed with counterpoint, then you're really challenging yourself to show this mastery of technique, or to indeed master it in the first place. But on the other hand, as you've just said, Laura, a lot of people who are not professional musicians aren't going to get it.
That's so true. And I know some composers feel that they want to write especially for an audience, a specific kind of audience. And I can't do that, really. I figured out years ago that if I have to write for myself, and I have to make myself happy. And that means that in some cities, in some places, some venues, the audience doesn't get it. And then in other venues, they do. And it's funny how you can never tell what venue it's going to be. You know, I presented at Yale recently, and you know, I thought, well, maybe my music isn't going to fit this group. And they loved it. I mean, every professor came, Aaron Kernis and Martin Bresnik and David Lang, they came, and they were all so over the moon about it, which I, you know, just melted my heart. I didn't expect that. But then, you know, in Oklahoma City, where I had a premiere of a piece, I thought they were going to run out of the doors screaming. And they actually gave me a standing ovation. So you never know, you know, when you think it's going to be an audience that's going to be moved by it. Sometimes they look at you like you're some strange alien. What have you, you know?
You don't know what you're going to get.
Well, and you're also dependent on the performers who are interpreting your work, there's this layer between you and that audience, too. Is there a piece that we can listen to now that'll give us a sample of your work, of your style?
Oh, absolutely. We could start with a piece called Waking Dream.
Do you think that the movies have kind of done a service or a disservice to classical music? Because when you say in a dream, it certainly is evocative of a dream. But I'm also resisting the urge to think of this as a soundtrack.
It's interesting. You know, I teach a class in film music every 3 years, and I love film music.
There's some
Bernard
good stuff
Herrmann's.
Out there, sure. Yeah, well, not to mention Prokofiev.
Oh, absolutely. Or Copland. These are all composers that growing up I listened to because I was a film fanatic. And I think that, you know, film music and classical music are really partners in essence now at this point, because the models for all the great film composers are the classics. Mahler, Debussy, Dvorak, you know, Holst.
Holst, I was going to mention, if you're talking in a kind of Star Trek film, for example.
Well, yeah. In this piece, The Waking Dream, it reminded me of The Afternoon of the Faun, the Debussy piece, just that mood of mysterious kind of in between waking and sleeping.
So,
thank you. That's a really nice comparison because I love that piece, and I'm a flutist.
Yeah, so. I played oboe in it, so I love that piece too.
Do you feel yourself ever as a composer of program music that would literally describe step by step some event or situation?
Oh, yeah. In fact, my bolero, I call it my bolero because it's been played by about 30 different groups, is a piece called High Wire Act. And it's been played at the Kennedy Center, and it's been played at the Corcoran Gallery of Art. I mean, all over the place. And the reason why it keeps getting played is because it has this narrative. It's based on the little circus figures of Alexander Calder, the Calder. And one movement's based on the High Wire Act, literally, and another one's the Aerialist. And so it has such a clear program and narrative that people are attracted to that, and they really like that. And I have to say that people in the audience respond in that way, too, because they see those things happening as they're listening to the music gives them something to grab onto.
With a piece like the one we just listened to, The Waking Dream, is there anything you can tell us about the process of writing? You know, in other words, if you can kind of think back to when you were working on it, does the flute melody come first and then you add in some of the percussion, or do you hear it as a whole?
Well, in this case, this flutist that I wrote it for, and by the way, I want to share that you just heard was our chamber orchestra from UW. It's the only live recording on the CD. The rest are made up of what we call the Madison Sinfonietta, which was an orchestra made up of faculty players and some of our best students. But that was the Wisconsin Chamber, our chamber orchestra with James Smith conducting.
Great
so
job.
If you can imagine, mm-hmm. I mean, he's done such an incredible job with that group over the years and with all his groups. This piece, you know, because I wrote it for my great friend Christina Jennings, who's my favorite flutist. I adore her. And you can hear how beautiful her sound mm-hmm. is. It melts your heart. It's just pure energy and vibrancy. And what I did was I really wrote it from A to B. I don't usually do that. I usually write in bits and pieces, like a motive here or a melody there. But with this piece, I picked up my flute and I wrote the flute part alone all the way through. And then I sat back and listened to sort of the harmonic framework, and that came second.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't usually happen, but because I'm a flutist and because mm-hmm. I know Christina's sound and I was writing it for her sound, it was a different sort of process for me.
So was this a pleasant dream?
You know, for me it is. But, you know, there is that double entendre. A waking dream is also psychologically
yeah,
that thing. You
sure.
wake up, you know, from a nightmare almost.
Yes.
And it does, this piece for me, you know, is very floaty and very beautiful, but it has a lot of intensity. And that's something I do in all my pieces. I'm an intense person. I can get very dramatic. I come from a background. My family's Jewish, and we show each other great affection and feed each other a lot of food. And I think that comes out in my music. There's the wail, the Jewish wail, in my music always. So I think that. That comes from a very, you know, also a dark place, but also a very real place, a sincere place.
And what kind of label would someone put on music like that? They had to say the Waking Dream is, you know, blank. What kind of style would it be labeled?
Well, I think for Waking Dream, I would think it's very colorful. It, to me, sounds very colorful, this piece. Mm-hmm. And the textures and the timbres that I explore are really silvery and golden and like Afternoon of the Fawn. Mm-hmm. I think they're about the sinewy and seductive nature of the instrument, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if I could just give it one label, because, again, that eclecticism's all the way through the piece.
And that kind of applies to music since, what, Rachmaninoff? What label do you put on it? If you put 20th century or contemporary, it really means even less than romantic or neo-romantic.
I think that's very true. And again, it's really the perspective of the audience, because some audiences find my music very romantic because I write these lines. They're really singable lines. Being a singer as well, I think in these long lines and that Brahmsian nature of these long phrases. I think that's also part of why people sometimes have a hard time listening to it, because there aren't little tidbits. You have to sort of stick in for the long haul towards leading somewhere, some big arrival. And I set up these large arrivals in the same way that maybe Brahms did. You know, not that I have his skill. I should be so lucky. But he, for me, at least in terms of the phrasing, is a great model. And but so that the perspective of the audience makes a big difference. Some people would listen to my music and think, oh, this is so hard to listen to. It's so modern, and would call it modern. And then other people would listen to it and think it's very, for instance, in Europe, not too long ago, I was lucky enough to be composer in residence in the city of Salzburg. It was a little stint. I stayed in an apartment. I had an office at the Mozarteum. I played my music for people there, and they thought it was just, you know, maudlin and romantic, and, you know, so it's really the perspective.
That leads me into a question we'll get into in a moment, which is what, generally speaking, do you see as the state of classical music being written today, and we'll look at that when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, composer Laura Schwendinger. And we're listening to some of her music, very highly rated, very well-received music among critics and many audiences alike, and fellow composers too, for that matter. But when we talk about contemporary classical music, it's a big world, and you just referred to being called romantic or even... Did you use the word schmaltzy? I can't remember.
Maudlin.
I don't know if that's the word they used. But
by other composers. So what do you see, big picture, as the state of contemporary classical music?
Well, I think we're going through a transition now. And it's one that has, you know, it's ripe with possibilities. And also, we don't know where it's leading. And that's exciting. We're right in the middle of it. It's like we're in the middle of the ocean and we sort of can't see the edges of it. And in that ocean is everything. You know, it's the minimalists and the post-minimalists and the post-post-minimalists and the deconstructionists and the modernists who are holding on to, you know, something of the past, and the eclecticists and the maximalists and every kind of ist you can imagine. And that's a good thing because there are audiences for all of those groups. And that might not have been true 50 years ago or 80 years ago. You had, you know, this whole thing going on with the downtown school and the uptown school in New York, and the never the twain shall meet there, you know. They didn't talk to each other. That wasn't the most healthy, I think, environment in some ways. And I think now it's a lot more healthy, and that students coming through having different approaches can do what they want to do. I mean, they can do it. And it won't necessarily be accepted by every audience, but there will probably be an audience that will be interested.
You mentioned earlier, Laura, that your style can be many different things. And if somebody just heard one of your pieces, they would get a misleading sense of what you do. We heard Waking Dream, a very mystical, very colorful. Can you give us an example of another piece that you've written that shows a different side of your writing?
I certainly can. The second movement of my cello concerto, which is the piece that either gets people excited about the complexity of my music or scares them away. And that in this feature is the wonderful Matt Heimovitz, who's, you know, one of the greatest cellists of our time. Thank you.
Is it okay if I say that reminds me of Bernard Herrmann?
Oh, that's a great compliment. He was such a wonderful composer.
Because I feel as if we're in the dream world again.
Oh, definitely. It's definitely dreamy, but a little bit more muscular than a waking dream. And the cello is working out more than anyone on earth.
That's a fantastic cello part. At some point, you're way up in the violin range.
He's on the A string, which is the top string for the cello, most of the concerto. And, you know, writing a cello concerto is actually one of the scariest things a composer can do. I think most composers out there will agree with me, because the cello has this great range. And Casals famously said it was the most like the human voice.
Yeah. Mm.
But the thing is that range is the range of the orchestra. You know, the violin can sit very, very high, and but the cello can be wiped out very, very easily by the acoustical properties of the orchestra. So
just blend in, you mean?
Exactly. That's why, you know, there are not a lot of cello sonatas by people you might expect there to be, because the piano eats up sort of the acoustical properties of the overtone series of the cello. So my response to that was to put him way up in the violin range on the cello. And he said, I think that this was, in terms of playing on the A string, the highest concerto that he's ever played.
It sounded that way, but it's very beautiful. It also, I guess the link that I hear with the Waking Dream piece was that the cello here, like the flute and the other piece, they seem to be like vocalists, you know, sort of speaking in a certain way.
You've really picked up on something because as a singer, I sing. And again, it's that wailing. It's the canter, wailing and singing at service. It's always there. Mm-hmm. And because I was a singer, I tend to sing the lines that I write. And in fact, my poor husband, listening to me compose, listens to me sort of singing all the lines as I play them on the piano. I'm sure it's not fun living with me.
I have a question. I don't think it's on the disc that you brought with us, but I did listen on your website, I think it is, to some excerpts from settings you've done of women writers, such as Christina Rossetti and Emily Dickinson and so on. Can you say a little bit about sort of some of your literary influences and what you do if you're setting a poem?
Oh, that's such a wonderful question. One of the classes I teach, and I teach it every other year, is text setting, because I think it's a real art. It's really difficult, and you have to think about prosody and strong and weak and cadence and all of that stuff. And so I've done a lot of text setting, and I've been lucky enough to write for Dawn Upshaw, who's recorded my music. And yeah, I love working with text, and I love setting works by women poets. Emily Dickinson, I've set maybe four or five of her poems, and it really gives you that narrative sense. The imagery of the poetry means so much. The texts mean so much, and so that's one of my favorite things to do, actually. And I find that it's something I go back to if I'm stuck on a piece, if I'm stuck on a string quartet and I can't figure out what the next phrase is going to be, I'll set a text.
Sure.
And then I'll go back.
I was just thinking about how so many early women writers had to use male pen names or to, you know, do all kinds of things to kind of break through the publishers. Do you find being a woman composer that you get certain kinds of reviewer comments or reactions that you might not if you were a man?
Yeah, you know, it's a hard thing to talk about. You know, I'll probably tell you a different thing than I would if we were sitting over a cup of tea at my house.
Oh no, we're not getting the straight story here.
I think the thing is that people to a certain degree expect a certain intensity and drive and even darkness. I mean, no one, you know, has a hard time with Stockhausen. They know who he is, but you know, you wouldn't sit there and say, you know, unless it wasn't your cup of tea directly, you expect something from him. But I think with women composers, they really are expected to write what we think of as pretty music. And I'll tell you a funny story. When my piece was first played at the Kennedy Center years ago with theater chamber players, Leanne Fleischer was co-director there with Dina Costin. Before the concert, we had a, you know, talk back session where people asked questions about the concert before it happened. And this person asked me a question. And then after the concert, he walked up to me and he congratulated me and he said, "Now I want to ask you what a nice girl like you is writing music like that for." And that sort of sums it up. I think people expect music by women to be sort of, you know, pretty and easygoing and easy to come to. And I think that there's a certain acceptance of music that's maybe a little grittier from men. And some of the reviews, I think, sort of show that I'm reviewed sometimes in a way that makes me sound like this ultra modernist. But you've heard my music now. It's romantic, really, on a lot of levels. And so some of the reviewers get that, but some of the reviewers are sort of echoing what that man said to me at the Kennedy Center all those years ago.
Do you think that that's sort of the last bastion to crack for women in music? It seems to me that women conductors might be painted with that same brush, that you would not expect them to have the grittiness in conducting an orchestra that you'd expect from a man. But there would be some people who would look at it that way.
I think you're right, Norman. I think that wall is starting to open up. You know, you have people like Maren Alsop or Nicole Paiement, who conducted this CD. You know, these people are doing strong, important things. In fact, Nicole just did a chamber version of The Great Gatsby in San Francisco, which got great reviews, and now they're going to be doing that same chamber music version at Tanglewood this summer. So I don't know if the listeners know about The Great Gatsby, a wonderful opera by Joan Harbison.
Sure, yeah. When you say chamber music version, she's conducting it?
She conducted it. She commissioned the chamber music version and conducted the premiere in San Francisco with her group, Ensemble Perrier. So she is, you know, she's one of these conductors. She conducts all over the place, Hollywood Bowl Orchestra and Houston Grand Opera. She's breaking that barrier as well. And her taste in music is very strong and somewhat modern. You know, she loves Harbison. I think Harbison's very beautiful, but other people might find Harbison more modern. It's, again, that perspective that's
you
coming.
Can be both, I would say yes, his music could go either way.
One of the works that that you have on the CD that you brought seems to take its title perhaps from the world of art. Can you talk about that?
That's my other great, great love is art. When we visit cities, we go straight to the art museum. So we were lucky enough to get to Paris recently. And I spent 4 days at the Louvre. And the Musée d'Orsay. So, as I said, I have this piece, High Wire Act, that's based on Alexander Calder's work. And so Chiaroscuro Azzurro is really referencing those great Caravaggists, Georges de la Tour, Caravaggio himself, this idea of dark and light superimposed,
the
contrast. And that's what I love. In my music, I try to do that. I try to have that sweetly singing line that was in that review. But I also really want some grittiness, because I feel like contrast is what makes music have shape and interest. If it's all just lovely, it just scoops together. And if it's all just gritty, you know, you're sort of, yes, you know, maybe in a Bernard Herrmann score.
Yeah, right, where you got the visuals to go with for a while. But it just seems like human nature anyway, that you need that contrast, that you need a break from either. And that's, of course, more true to life anyhow. You can have a very sweet thing going on in the foreground and then something grittier in the background in life all the time. It works that way. And that's what's coming out in this chiaroscuro of yours.
That's what I tried to do with this piece. So Violin concerto that's Chiaroscuro Azzurro was commissioned by Miller Theater in New York, and Jennifer Coe premiered it, this wonderful upcoming young violinist. She actually just played for the New York Phil last week and got a great review in the Times. So I wanted to exploit the beauty of the violin, because what an instrument. I mean, just incredible. But I also wanted the violin. I wanted to see if I could get the violin to sound, you know, more like an electric guitar. And that doesn't mean I was referencing, you know, pop music so much as just that grittiness that you get, you know, sometimes in the darkest of Bartok or, you know, or Ludus Lasky. I wanted to see how dirty sounding I could get the violin. So they're both in this piece. And whenever I think about this piece, I think about a Georges de la Tour painting where you see the brightness of the flame and it's very hot, and the darkness of the background, which is sort of moody, and the contrast between the two. So what we're going to hear is the music that comes right after this long opening cadenza, and the violin leads in the soft orchestral sound with the harp. Thank you.
I don't know if music analysts still do this, but it used to be quite popular to take, a symphony by Tchaikovsky, what we call absolute music, and put all kinds of storyline to it, not in the sense of program music, but, fate comes triumphant, and mankind is vindicated and all of this. Do people ever do that with your music, Laura?
I think so. Every once in a while at a concert, after a concert, someone will come up to me and say, I heard this and this and this and this in your piece. And it's interesting how varied that can be,
sure.
People hearing very different things.
But what's really nice about that is they're imagining things. So it's getting their brain working and they're thinking. And that means they're engaged. It's a whole lot better than the person who's sitting there who's not sure and, is reading the, by the third minute is looking at the program and moving the page back
or texting or something. Yes. So when you've got the violin and the percussion or the violin and the harp or different things going on, what did you sort of imagine or hear or feel?
Well, in this particular movement, I have these two worlds. Again, this beautiful world of the violin, with this motive that's sort of evocative of a falling figure, yada, ba-dum, this falling second figure. And that's all very sweet. But then, as Norman was saying, the boxer, when we were sort of listening to it, the boxer comes in and sort of makes his way in there. And that's that gritty thing.
Punches us.
It punches us, yeah. Mm-hmm. So that it sort of wakes us from our torpor of the beautiful violin soloist. And that's the idea behind that. It's to give us both worlds. Who does this and I think does it to the greatest effect, really, in this century is Prokofiev. Prokofiev's music, we have this great, beautiful singing, high violin stuff, and then all of a sudden we're in the land of the comic, and yet somehow they go together.
Well, yeah, Shostakovich maybe even more so with those kind of forced smiles of his, and he had good reason in Stalinist Russia to write things that way.
Or Stravinsky, but I'm guessing that no riots have been started yet by your music.
Not that I know of.
We're going to look at some more of the music of Laura Schwendiger when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is composer Laura Schwendiger, and we are talking about her world as a composer and hearing some of her music. If you could write your own review of your music, the way Walt Whitman, published reviews of himself, if you could write just like a couple sentences, what would you want it to say about your music if you could kind of write your own review?
Oh, I love that. That's fascinating. I really haven't thought about that. Sort of like thinking about your obituary, what it would say.
We won't go there, though.
Well, this month, actually, just coming up, Fanfare just went online with three reviews of this recording that we're listening to today. And all three of them are wonderful reviews. And the one by, I think his name is Barnaby Rayfield. He's from England. It comes very close to saying all the things that I have been saying about my music. I mean, he understands the drama, the singing line that you talked about, and just the fact that I'm trying to write music that's beautiful but not always pretty. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate when people are willing to come to it and really listen to it in that way. So,
And of all the things that you've written, all the different concertos, chamber pieces, pieces with piano, just different things you've done, are there ones that for you stand out as your favorites, the things where you think it's just the best thing you've done?
Well, in fact, I think the last thing I'm going to share with you today is one of my favorite movements. It's the second movement of the violin concerto. And it's the piece that when I listen to it, I think, well, you know, maybe I do have a future in this composition racket, you know, because we're all self-critical and wonder some days, you know, why are we doing this, you know? Yeah, so I'd love to share that with you so you could hear a little bit of the thing about this movement. I think that's different than some of the other movements is that there is this expansiveness in a way in the ending, and then also this intimacy in the solo violin that you don't get in the other movements. It's quite fragile. So it does both of those things, and it doesn't, the boxer doesn't make an entrance. It's sort of just my heart put on a plate. Maybe I should put it that way. So this is the ending of it, of that movement.
So when you put your heart on a plate like that, what's it like working with the performers? Do they ever say things like, well, this is a very nice piece. I'm just not sure my violin can take it. Or do they say you're pushing the envelope here? Or is it always a positive experience?
Oh, that's a wonderful, wonderful question, because collaboration is, I think, the most fun a part of what we do as composers. We get to really know these players, and they get to know us. So we see their inner soul, and they have to play our inner soul. And that's a very intimate relationship in a lot of ways. And sometimes it's perfunctory. They haven't quite gotten it, or they don't like it. You know, sometimes they fall in love with it, and you become fast friends. It's like you connect in a way you couldn't otherwise. And for instance, the violinist that you just heard play that piece, Curtis McCumber, who teaches at Juilliard, is the most elegant and refined of men and plays with that beautiful elegance. So he was gentle with my heart, I have to say. And his wife, of course, was the final producer on this, Judith Sherman, who's won many Grammys for her work in classical music. So it was finally gift wrapped in this beautiful sheen of hers. So I have to say, often you give your heart, and if it's sincere, the response is one that you know you will remember forever. You really enjoy it.
So what's the next direction for you as a composer?
That's an interesting question because we were talking earlier about this piece that I'm working on right now, which is due in about 2 weeks for the new Juilliard Ensemble. And it's going to be played at Avery Fisher Hall at Lincoln Center. And it's my first Lincoln Center performance.
They won't be playing it in 2 weeks, but they have to have it in their hands.
To have it in their hands, which is frightening.
No pressure.
What a wonderful venue.
It is. And I'm excited about it, but I'm not quite finished with the piece. And I sort of feel like, those stories of the composer finishing the piece. Gunther, I think, told me he finished a piece on a train once. That's sort of how I feel like I'm up against this deadline. And the reason why it's coming so close to the deadline isn't just because we're starting classes, but because the movement I'm working on sort of takes me in a little bit of a right or left turn, depending on how you see things. And it's a direction I haven't really encountered or gone, I haven't explored before. So it's scary. It's scary. So I can come back to you in about, 3 months and tell you whether it worked out. But
well, are you one of these composers? I mean, I've heard one case where literally the scores are down there in the pit or wherever, and the composer is down there correcting, changing notes. I mean, at what point do you say it's done?
It's really expected of us to make sure that the parts, when they arrive, are close to as perfect as possible. But I have a lovely story that has to do with this. Many years ago when I was at UC Berkeley and I was an assistant to the conductor, I was also the librarian for the orchestra there and played principal flute in the orchestra. And we did Pelléas and Mélisande by Debussy. And we found 1,200 to 1,300 errors in the scores and parts.
Wow.
And, these were the rental parts that had been played by every opera company, in the world. So even though we expect our composition students to prepare perfect parts, there are so many thousands of observation points, every note, every stem, every dot,
right,
every rest, that it's really impossible to give perfect parts and a perfect score. And so that comes with the collaboration. The conductor finds things that they think look different and should look different, and they tell you about it. So I am sort of one of those composers, but I try not to be. I try to be a little bit more prepared and organized.
And maybe a mistake becomes something exciting.
I have worked mistakes into final scores that I liked better than what I did. So
there you go. Improv.
So original. Well, our guest has been Laura Schwendinger, and thank you for giving us some insight into the world of contemporary classical music from the viewpoint of a composer.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me. It's been so much fun.
Pleasure having you over. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.